Spurgeon. How are you guys doing?
Very well, thank you. It's good to talk to you both.
Yeah, doing well. Having a good week, I'd say. Good to hear from you guys.
I agree. So in the Midwest here, this is actually quite awesome. So tomorrow is the last frigid day. It seems like after tomorrow, everything's going to be like 30 degrees and above.
Oh, nice. That's 30 degrees Celsius.
No, that's Fahrenheit. That's Fahrenheit.
Because out here, it's been 75, 80, pretty consistently. We did have a little drizzle a couple days ago, and everybody got everybody's, you know, panties in a bunch.
We've had snow, but I've never had. We had like kind of freezing rains, freezing rain type of stuff, and it was quite interesting to drive on at 6 a.m. when it wasn't plowed. No one plowed it, and it was just like these. Like giant ice balls that you were driving on. It was quite interesting.
Oh, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, we had bad weather. You actually had to use an umbrella while golfing.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, and you had to to wipe the sweat off of your brow.
You had to wipe the drizzle off of your brow.
Life is so hard. And,
all right, so let's talk about making life easier. How about that? And so, did you guys hear that the Hyperloop is going to be built in Central California next year? The prototype of it.
What's a Hyperloop?
Do you remember that?
That sounds so familiar.
Okay, so Elon Musk produced a white paper, a 57-page white paper in August 2013, and it was based upon the concept of the thing called a Hyperloop, which is pretty much a depressurized tube that can take maglev, at speeds in hopes of achieving from LA to San Francisco a distance of 400 miles in about 30 minutes. And so the first 5-mile test track is going to be built halfway between LA and San Francisco in a place called Quivonia. And I didn't know about this place, and I looked it up, and it's actually a 75,000 person place that is being built, and it was on delay because of the economic turmoil, and then there was like a giant lawsuit. The lawsuit went to trial in 2014 and was settled. In 2015, they got all of their stuff rezoned. So it's actually being built with this as one of the hubs alongside I-5 halfway between LA and San Francisco. 20 homes, 75,000, 5,000 people. It's going to be a giant entertainment center as well as like huge parks. And it's supposed to bring like greenery, and it's going to be supposed to be 100% sustainable, right?
So the idea is if they finish this whole Hyperloop.
No, the Hyperloop has nothing to do with Quai Valley, but it's like an addition. They're kind of signing a deal, and they're saying, okay, this company called Hyperloop Transportation Technologies can go ahead with this agreement to build this Hyperloop there.
It sounds
there
like
as
this town is just trying to bring in new businesses, bring in new.
Well, the concept is for this to be a test track and then to have the actual one from LA to San Francisco go along I-5 right through here. Right, and be built actually.
So they kind
of
incorporated in part of it, I guess.
Correct. Yeah.
That's cool.
How crazy would that be?
This thing, I'm looking at this thing. They're looking at a top speed of 760 miles an hour.
Whoa.
Right.
Holy cow.
Right?
Yes.
And average speed of around 600 miles an hour, 598 miles per hour.
Yeah, wow. maglev pods in a giant tube. But it'll get you there quick, and we don't need trains, son.
I
we don't need trains.
YouTube. I can't wait to see the accidents.
Oh, don't say that. We don't want to see this crash ever.
Well, this probably, I mean, the way it's set up, it's a smart idea because
it looks like a robust design. Yeah.
What's that?
It looks like a robust design.
I think if it's designed well, yeah, it should be fairly safe.
Well, here's the other thing. It sounds like it's going to be like basically a reduced pressure tube. So I imagine that one of the built-in safety features is that they lose pressure anywhere along the line. It probably slows the whole thing down. You know what I'm saying? So,
It's got to have something like that because, like, hitting a little bit of air, it's supposed to be depressurized, not a little bit of air. It's literally depressurized. There's no air.
Right.
That's the way you can go this fast.
Wow. So does this thing, like, I guess it's going to have to go through, like, an airlock or something.
Correct.
Going into that's
Hey, this is like isn't this like what's in all the movies though?
That's exactly what I was gonna say. Well, I've imagined.
Like, this
that
is how you're supposed to travel. Why are you traveling on a train? Where are you from? Yeah, 2014. Right. That's what I thought.
Yeah, you get the little pod and it goes through a tube. That's
It reminds me a little bit of those things that you used to use to at the bank. Are you guys old enough for that?
Yeah.
Where you would be able to send your stuff through the. It's basically like that, you know, like putting people in one of those things just gets sucked
Except
up in there.
Goes 700 something miles an hour.
Right, 760 miles an hour.
That's.
But
that's
so it's kind of right.
Yeah, that is cool. I wonder why they haven't done something like this from like L.A. to Vegas though. I think that would be.
Well, I think L.A. to San Francisco is more economically important instead of like recreationally important. So that's why putting the one from San Francisco to Vegas or San Francisco to L.A. will actually yield an economic benefit, which will yield those other ones like Vegas and other lines like Phoenix. Next, it'll be Phoenix and Vegas, and then it'll expand from there, right? From LA.
Well, once one of them is
LA
built,
will be the central hub.
Once one of them is in place, and we know that it works, and if it turns out that it actually makes money, that it actually really works well, that people want to use it, then
oh, if it works, people will use it. I mean, yeah.
They'll be all over the place.
Yeah, of course.
Well, each one's supposed to cost about $6 to $7 billion.
Oh, sweet.
which is big money.
We could just cut aid to like three countries and we would have that. Why don't we do that? Like, let's just cut aid to like three. Let's just cut military aid to like three or four countries and be like, all right, let's build this transportation line.
Yeah, to benefit a few people that need to get to San Francisco really fast.
Did you guys ever
in 30 minutes? Are you kidding me? That would change. You could have an office between LA and San Francisco, and there would be, it would be just like having an office between Palm Desert and Palm Springs, right?
Sure.
There'd be no difference.
Except for there's always. They obviously can't run that many at a time, right? So you'd probably have to have one going one way, one going the other way. They'd be running them every half hour, I suppose, or something like that, or whatever, 45 minutes.
If they have
no,
two
they could.
Lanes,
they'd probably run
one going
much
one
more
way,
constantly
one going
than
the
that.
Direction.
Yeah, because there'd be it would be no different than like a highway.
Yeah.
Think of it like a highway.
I wonder. Right. I just wonder. I mean, you know, you have
it'd be
to
maglev controlled and everything.
Yeah. I mean, you'd have to have a lot of seats essentially. And then, you know, there's probably a wait to get on. It's like, you know, I mean, I don't know. I don't think it's going to happen. Okay. My money's on it's not going to happen.
You're such a pessimist.
I think Elon Musk has got a lot of really fantastic ideas.
He has nothing to do with this. He just put the idea out there and someone else grasped onto it and they're doing it.
Right. But I'm saying he's got some great ideas. And if he was putting his money on the line, perhaps it would get done. But I wonder very much if this is really going to happen, or if it's kind of
well. That shall
you know,
be seen.
I've seen less ridiculous ideas that are cheaper than $6-7 billion
that are more achievable
not get built.
That
right,
are more
exactly.
achievable.
Right. So this is I'd have to agree. I honestly don't see this ever happening.
All
right.
So did you guys
future.
Hear about the?
I'd
let's
love
switch
it
to humans. I want to talk about humans now.
Okay.
Did you guys hear about the 2.8 million year old specimen of a Jabba?
Yeah.
I saw headlines.
Okay. Well, headlines.
So
tell me about it.
I saw the jaw, the piece of jawbone with some teeth in it.
Yes.
Didn't
you see? You were like, oh, yeah, I recognize that one. That proves that there was a clear link between Lucy 3.2 million years ago as Australopithecus and the human-like primate that we know from 2.4 million years that we didn't have the leak from 2.8 million years ago. Duh.
Well, obviously, there are experts that might be able to put that stuff together. It is pretty interesting. You know, it is pretty interesting how you know, you can – those people that really have expertise in something – you know what I mean? How much nuance there probably is in the shape of the teeth and the shape of the jawbone and all that stuff that the average person would never be able to, you know,
right.
even fathom.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
I agree.
It's like any other, either one of your expertise is the same way. You know, when somebody comes up to you and starts talking about material science, Scott, or you know, something with you, Blake, for physics or whatever, you know, you're probably thinking, okay, this person really doesn't understand this stuff at all. You know what I mean? The
I don't go into it
person.
Whatsoever with that thought process.
What's
but
that?
I do understand that a lot of people do sometimes.
Is that like this, there's probably a lot that they can tell from a very small piece of bone.
Right.
You know
so what they were saying was that previously the oldest fossil attributed to the Homo genus was an upper jaw from Ethiopia from 2.35 million years ago, and this one's at 2.8 million years ago. And this is just like the five teeth, pretty much, right?
Yeah, it is pretty amazing though that those teeth look like just look like what you would expect human molars to look like. You know what I mean? They do look. They don't look like fangs or anything like that.
It's the left side of the lower jaw.
So what are they saying about this? Are they saying it's the oldest fossil of humans?
That can be attributed to humans.
In like our current species.
Well, that has been found on an archaeological dig.
So these are, but this is not modern human. This is like a...
they're to
like
the genus. No, yeah, it's the genus Homo. It's right after Lucy, pretty much.
Right, so she's Australopithecus... Africans or something like that, right?
They don't technically have the link from like them. There's that missing link, right, between humans and Lucy, and this is like closer to that link, right?
Okay.
Because Lucy's 3.2 million years, this one's 2.8, the other ones were 2.0. There's other ones along like closer, but though that link in between like 2.35 and 3.2, we don't really have anything there.
Yeah, well,
that makes sense.
This reminds me a little bit of, I was doing a little bit of reading, and we've already talked in the past about the, what are the Hobbit people, what are they called?
Yeah, I don't remember what those ones.
Oh,
I mean,
there's
like the Denisovans, but those aren't the Hobbit people. Yeah.
No. But at the same time, so anyway, it was an interesting article.
Hobbit
about
people. Let's just call them Hobbit people. I'm fine with that.
Right. The smallish humanoid creatures or skeletons that they found. Found so far. They were living at the same time as the Denisovans and also Neanderthals. And so at that time there might have been a more the Earth was populated by a variety of
That's what I was going to actually. Hold on, let me cut you off. There was a 22,000-year-old skull that was found back in the 1970s, and it sat in a museum, and then it was like kind of recently re-examined, and they noticed a few oddities, and they think that it could possibly come from a new, different type of humanoid from around 22,000 years ago. And because it kind of looks like human, but there's a few features that differentiate from normal human and could point to a completely different humanoid.
So wow. Like a sort of different branch then.
Well, right. There's humans, there's Denisovans, there's Neanderthals. Wow. And then what if there's a fourth, right? I remember when I was going through school, which was, I mean, I just got through my 10-year reunion, right, last year. We were just hearing about Neanderthals, really, right? I mean, in terms of like actual facts, and now there's
and now that
we're at three, and now maybe even four.
Time. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be so interesting to have lived in that time? I mean, just having thought of like.
No, I don't think it would have. I think you would have short, brutal life, and it would have not been too great.
But think about if that was like true today. If on other continents there was other species of humans.
that would be crazy. Like what if there actually was war that somehow, the way that the war was conducted and the way that people built their species back then, just talking hypothetically, right? If there was a way for them to actually do something like, 15,000 years ago and there was like a war, I guess there could have been some way that it would have been erased from the planet, but think of that, flying ships of different creatures fighting each other. That would actually be quite a good video game.
Sounds like a pretty sweet work of fiction, I'd say.
I know, great video game.
I think what we understand is that basically the reason why we are the ones that sort of survived to this day is that everywhere we went, we just either killed or had sex with the other groups, or some.
Well, yeah, because we realized we don't have to kill them.
Right. Well, some of them, like there's some indication that certain, like some Neanderthal DNA is still present in certain ethnicities of humans. You know what I mean? So
no, yeah, like, so like there must certain have been some areas of Asia where there's like 15%. Yeah.
So yeah, genetically, yeah. We came in, took everything that we liked about them, incorporated it into ourselves, and then let the rest die out. What happened. And just kind of the way that evolution works.
Yeah, exactly.
But in the end, the species that's a great end
to like think of like a public service announcement on evolution. That's the way evolution works.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think about, you know, that wasn't that long ago in terms of, you know, geological history, at least.
Right, so 22,000 years.
22,000 years ago. I mean, we think of that as a long time, but that's nothing really in terms of human history.
Yeah.
That there was quite a bigger variety. And I imagine as soon as we started expanding our territory and moving out, I mean, modern humans, and we would encounter these other species, we'd probably just kill them off. And make sex with women.
Oh, make sex with ladies. Okay, that's very good. I don't know if either of you had heard about this, but they took the first ever, quote, photograph, unquote, of light as both a particle and a wave.
Yeah, I saw that. I actually saw the picture.
Isn't that interesting?
And it kind of looks like what you'd expect it to look like.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's
weirdly.
All right.
It's quite good. What do you mean by photograph?
Like, how did they take the photograph?
Yeah.
So first of all, the research team is led by Fabrizio Carbone. That's EPFL, and so what they did is this is how they so a pulse of laser light is fired at a tiny metallic nanowire. The laser adds energy to the charged particles in the nanowire, causing them to vibrate. Light travels along this tiny wire in two possible directions, like cars on a highway. When waves travel in opposite directions, meet each other, they form a new wave that looks like it is standing in place. Here, the standing wave becomes the source of light for the experiment, radiating around the nanowire. This is where the experiment's trick comes in. I'm reading this. Okay. The scientist shot a stream of electrons close to the nanowire, using them to image the standing wave of light. As the electrons interacted with the confined light on the nanowire, they either sped up or slowed down. Using the ultrafast microscope to image the position where this change in speed occurred, Carbone's team could now visualize the standing wave, which acts as a fingerprint of the wave nature of light.
You know, I'm not going to say I understood entirely everything that was going on and completely followed it, but that sounds awesome.
So from my understanding, they had a standing wave of light that they produced, essentially, and then they fired photons at it or something.
Electrons
at it, and then they were able to see the photons coming off.
They were able to see the electron scattering and interpret that as this waveform.
That's pretty neat. So what does it look like then?
If you look at it, it looks exactly like a particle and a wave at the same time. It's basically like the thing I saw was like a square with like waves, like a square plane of material, let's just say. If you're visualizing it with waves at different wavelengths of light in like bulging out of the material across basically both planes in the horizontal axis. So you have from one end to the other, it's going from red to blue and the wavelengths are getting longer and the wavelengths are then also spread across the other axis as well.
Well, that's just visualization of the graph. The graph's actually over the more of the spectrum than just the visual light, right?
Right. But what I mean to say is that it kind of looks like what you would expect the cross between a particle and a wave to look like, meaning that this packet of light can travel as a particle, but it's got this wave-like characteristic to it. Therefore, that enables it to interact like a wave.
Right, it moves in a wave-like manner.
Right, it moves in a wave-like manner.
The packet, the quanta of light move in a wave-like manner, and this is the image of that light movement.
Right, exactly. Huh. Exactly. It's pretty, I mean, if you look at the picture, it's like, okay, now I see how this double split experiment could create the what they're creating, which is that if you have the if they're able to interact with one another because they move in a wave like manner, they can create this interference pattern, but they're still individual, you know, individual photons.
Right, and keep
you know?
In mind that this is a standing wave, so this isn't like a photon individually. It's a standing wave of, you know, constant interference patterns of the wave-like nature, creating a constant standing wave of the particles that are now being part of that wave, right?
So right. It's a large number of photons in sort of like a beam, and it's sort of a picture of like what that beam looks like in sort of a way. Of what, like
that,
a large
that
amount
beam,
of photons all
that beam that is spreading along a nanowire looks like.
Ah,
yes.
Right.
So it does, you know, the whole particle wave duality thing was always sort of hard to visualize in my mind. I feel like I can visualize it now. You know what I mean? Just seeing this picture. You got to look at the picture because it does all of a sudden go, oh, okay, well, now that sort of makes sense, you know? Like just.
Yeah,
there's something about visualizing something.
I mean, when you see
it
changes, right? I agree.
Yeah,
I'll have
yeah.
to look that up. That sounds pretty.
Yeah, have a look because it does look like a particle that's sort of moving in a wave-like fashion, or like basically consists of you know undulations. Yeah.
Interesting. Oh, neat. Huh. I see that on a lot of textbooks in the future. I hope.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure
people
we will,
understand
yeah.
how it works. Well, I've got a topic I think would be fun to talk about. I was looking up something. I got this article on some technology that Google is developing to tell whether facts on the internet are true or not.
Huh.
So the idea is that a team of computer scientists at Google, according to the Washington Post, has proposed a way to rank search results not by how popular the web pages are, but by their factual accuracy.
Oh, this is a good idea.
I know, right? It's because so much on the internet is just straight up wrong.
Yeah, it'd be nice if you got an email. You know, we all get emails from that, you know, hardcore, you know, political left or right, mostly politically right wing person.
I don't know. I think it's both sides, buddy.
I don't know. I don't think it's as equal on both sides, but that's just my opinion. Where you get this email and you're like, this is clearly bullshit. You know what I mean? This is clearly not true.
100%.
Right. You know, and you're like,
I'm gonna go with no on that one.
Yeah, it's no.
Well, now Google is gonna do the same, but in a sort of meta sense, in that they keep this sort of database of information that they gather from various places. And I guess they keep a lot of information in it. And I guess they found a way of sort of referencing this information in order to roughly check facts. So just general facts, I guess.
Right, right.
And so yeah, it says the idea.
Instantaneous fact checking, yeah.
Yeah, so the idea is to validate right. your fact. You only need a fact and a reference work to compare it to. And so they already have the reference work, and now they're just kind of really working on a way to compare Google searches with that database in order to essentially functions based
yeah,
on fact, which just sounds, I don't know, amazing.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be really fantastic. But the problem is that if fact is the problem with our own cognitive bias, is that as soon as you saw a fact that Google disagreed with what you thought was correct, you'd go, oh, well, Google's run by a bunch of left-wing wackos, so therefore this can't be true. You know what I'm saying? Like, we have
yeah.
these – our cognitive biases are so strong that even when presented with facts, it just solidifies people's
it's
you know,
true.
They're feeling – they're like they hold on to their beliefs even stronger, you know?
And I think it's also – it comes – there's an issue of the nature of what a fact is, right?
Sure.
It's
oh,
that,
yeah.
You know – we can know facts, like, collectively. Everyone can scientifically agree on something. And it turns out that that thing that we've been agreeing on for this whole time has been wrong the whole time, right? So
sure.
At a certain point, when they say they need a fact or a statement and a reference to compare it to, you have to assume that that reference is correct. And even if that reference is something very generally correct most of the time,
well,
I'll tell you this.
A fact is something that you have yet to prove wrong, right? That's what a fact
sure.
is.
Right.
So I'm going to go, as long as Google ranks the stuff in terms of amount of proof wrong, I'm okay with it, right? Because there is nothing that is factually 100% correct to everybody everywhere. I mean, there are physics equations that generally you don't go to somewhere else on the planet. That's the whole, you know, point is that they you don't go somewhere else and they don't change. But there are other things that, you know, some have small amounts of facts against them and some have larger amounts of facts against them. So if Google ranks them that way, then it might actually, you know, show some promise.
Well, that's more scientifically accurate as far as the scientific method and whatnot. But I think that's different than what they're proposing here. And I think you're right about that sort of issue is even if something that's a widely accepted fact gets proven wrong once, you never know. That one person proving it wrong.
Well, they could have been doing their stuff. Well, they could have been doing their, you know, studying correctly.
Exactly. Or they could be the first person to actually discover that, hey, turns out this thing that we've generally accepted to be true for a long time is actually wrong. But then when something like a Google search becomes the basis of what is fact or not, it becomes much harder to change that sort of collective knowledge of what makes a fact a fact.
Well, I think
it's tricky.
You know, well, I think there's a problem using the word fact. You know, if there was something, I know this term is not going to be the most, it's going to be a little cumbersome, but what you're looking for really is preponderance of evidence. You know what I mean? You're looking for
preponderance of evidence.
Preponderance
that's,
of evidence.
That's pretty.
So there could be like a little scale, or there could be like a little, you know, rating system, whereas this is the preponderance of evidence is pushing it this way by 20% or 30%, you know what I'm saying? So this one has a lot of evidence supporting
right, this one is like, well, I mean, yeah, like 95% likely that this article contains very factual information.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. I'm okay right. with that. So I'm okay with that reading scale, something. Oh, okay, all
right. Right, and then there would be like a little, there could be a little on each, you know, like.
Well, no, it's like, it's like there's only 5% of this bullshit I have to read out of this, I have to weed out of this article. Oh, that's nice. That's actually quite nice. All right.
Yeah, only, yeah. Well, so like when I do a Google search, for instance, and I have a web software, I have software on my, a plugin on my browser that tells me if a website is safe to click on, that it's not going to give me
the heebie-jeebies,
virus or you know, that kind of thing. So my browser is able to instantly tell me if I should click on something or not based on, you know, other data it's collected. But if it showed like a little one of these, like a little gauge, you know, and the little gauge is like, you know, this is bullshit, this is a bullshit page, and this is, or this is factual, and you're like, oh, try to stick with stuff that's all in the factual range, right. You know what I mean, then that kind of would give you some guidance instead of like just blindly, you know, right now the way you search, you know, like you'll hear people make comments, or you'll see stuff on YouTube, and then you'll go search that thing because you want to find out if it's true or not. And what ends up happening is the first 20 websites that come up are all people that are supporting that viewpoint, and they're all coming at it from like a particular point of view. You know what I mean? So like, let's say it's a, you know, something that's anti-Obama. Well, then the first 20 websites are all going to be like right-wing hardcore websites, whereas I'm looking for something that's sort of independent, like a, you know, as independent as possible. So like maybe an NPR, or it's not purely one way or the other, you know. Then you might debate that, well, none of them are purely one way or the other, but something that's a little bit more kind of down the middle, so I can get a more balanced view of whatever this is going on. But the way Google works now is that's not what comes up. What comes up are the people that are talking about it the most are going to be the ones with the hardest core believing that thing. You know what I'm saying? They're the people that are most.
I think you just came down to the root of one of the big problems in our political system right now.
Right,
the only people you hear talking are the people on either ends of the spectrum.
Well, so that's the thing. That's the thing. If you want to know, like, the lifeblood of something, what do? Right? You have to listen to the people involved that are actually making the decisions. So I understand that. I agree. I love to read the stuff that you're talking about, Kurt. But if I like, you know, I'm like, oh, I really want to understand what's going on here, I just watch CNN for a half hour, and then I switch over to Fox for a half hour, and then I switch over to CNN for a half hour, and I really understand the issue after that because I'm like, oh, okay, I get it.
It does make a lot of sense.
So you go to CNN and you hear something that's fairly, and then you go to Fox and you hear complete bullshit. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's complete bullshit on both sides. That's the point. There's
CNN
independent articles that like there's certain AP articles, and then there's like the BBC's actually quite good, and then there's a few other things like that are actually quite good in terms of taking political commentary and not dealing with it from a perspective, but from a CNN or a Fox News perspective. No, it's not. It's not unbiased.
No, not at all.
I think CNN is CNN's less biased than Fox News, but I would still not call it entirely unbiased, I would say.
I think it's pretty clear. I think CNN is everybody's less biased than Fox News.
It's a good point.
Well, I would say that everything that we're talking about right now is subjective, as there is no way to actually tell what a bias is. But from somebody who I feel does approach it unbiasedly, I do watch equal time of all channels. I do not just take channels off based on other things. I do ABC and other things too. And Fox News isn't any more unbiased than CNN in the allotted time that I give said channel. So I'll put it that way.
Well,
I do give it that time.
There have been studies that have shown that they lie more than everyone else. So Fox News does. So that's been documented, but whatever, you know, I'm just saying, I mean, you know, I'll listen to anybody, but
CNN over here.
No, I'm not saying CNN's the
50% of the time it works every time.
I'm just saying that I try to stay away from stuff that is documentedly biased. And like that could be, you know, Glenn Beck's network.
It's actually quite good to understand political commentary when you see it from a biased perspective, because you understand the whole point of the conversation. You're not even having the conversation unless you understand why people are on opposite sides, because otherwise you just like make a compromise and move on, right?
It's about putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, right?
That'd be called progress, not politics. What's your problem,
Kurt? No.
We're not looking for progress. We're looking for politics.
The problem is all right, well, we probably should get away from politics, but the problem is that when there's blatant disregard for the truth,
that's where you have
problems. Like I saw something today, and they were saying that whatever. Anyway, you see stuff that's a blatant disregard for the truth, and that's totally different than having a different opinion about something. I have no problem with people having a different opinion, but when they literally are taking what we know is truth or is pretty high on that scale that we just talked about as having a fairly high amount of factual evidence supporting it, and they're saying something completely the opposite, it gets a little bit the kind of bias.
All right, so let's talk about Ceres.
That's why it would be nice to have Google.
You guys want
to
talk about Ceres?
Tell you somewhat factual. Right?
Oh,
right,
it would be. Exactly. It would be. I want unbiased Google. I don't want anybody paying them for this either. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, I know.
So,
right?
So did you guys hear about Ceres?
Google search sponsored by Fox News.
Did you hear about all those bright spots on Ceres?
Did we hear what? Yeah.
Those bright spots on Ceres?
Oh yeah, I did hear about that.
So there's a spacecraft that's approaching Ceres, which is a minor planet that is an asteroid type orbiting the sun, and it is approaching it. It's now only like 20,000 miles away, and it's entering orbit on Friday around Ceres. And as it's been approaching, it's been seeing these reflective spots, and there's been one, and now there's two. And they've been, what are they kind of thing, right? But they were thinking, is it water? People were thinking it was like volcanoes, but it's unlikely that it's a volcano. But it does look kind of like a little water spot at the giant meteor crater. But we'll see as the orbiter gets closer. But it's quite interesting because remember that we also have a probe that's going to get to Pluto in I think like July or August this year. So we're going to see what Pluto looks like by the end of 2015, guys.
Oh, interesting.
Wow.
Well, there could be some sort of liquid, other liquid gas, it could be like liquid nitrogen or something like that. That's not, aren't
yeah,
there,
we'll
aren't
see.
there, isn't there, aren't there seas of liquid? Yeah. Any kind of
I don't think it's a liquid. It's probably a solid, like frozen. It looks like.
Yeah, it could be. It could be shiny. Like
I mean, I guess it could be a liquid. It's possible. Anything's possible, right? We've never been there. How do we know?
Right, right.
But so you're saying it's likely that it's reflective. You said.
Right, right. So what?
Not
like a liquid.
Well, it looks reflective.
Right,
right. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks reflective based on this.
Oh no, that's like an alien with like this huge LED.
Yeah, it's. I was gonna say it's definitely an alien civilization
with some bioluminescent, like
right.
It's a trap.
That's
trying
gotta
to capture
be.
Flying probes that go over.
Well, so supposedly Ceres is about 20% water ice. So this, you know, it's most likely it's like kind of like ice or something.
Yeah, it's probably an ice. Neat. Yeah, yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, I'm looking at pictures now, and yes, it looks like an ice patch or something.
Yeah, so, NASA's Dawn mission.
And remind me, you said how soon is it going to be that they land?
Friday,
on
March 6th, man. Two days.
Oh, sweet.
There's a lot going down March 6th.
What else
There's
is March 6th?
Well, I can tell you. Would you like to know?
I would like to know what's going down on March 6th, my friend.
Okay. Well, there's a few things. There's an opening, a movie. There's two movies I'm very interested in.
Oh, what are they?
One movie's called What We Do in the Shadows. Have you heard about this?
No.
Have you ever seen the guys from Flight?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so those guys.
Funny guys.
Those guys have a movie coming out. It's like a mockumentary about vampires.
Okay.
And it looks hilarious. So What We Do in the Shadows, it's been very highly rated on March 6th. In fact, the wife and I are going to go see that on Friday night and do a little
Excellent.
Dinner movie. And then Slava Voynov, which is he's the defensive lineman for the or the D-man defensive player for the LA Kings his trial starts March 6th. And then this we're landing on Ceres, and then there's another movie coming out, two movies coming out that I've been hearing about. They're supposed to be really good. So it's a big day. A big
nice.
Day on wow. March 6th. A bunch of movies coming out and there's a trial starting that I'm interested in following. So, you know, a lot going on tomorrow.
All right.
Wow.
So the last topic I wanted to talk about
Friday.
Was also about being happy, like what you're talking about. March 6th.
Being happy?
Well, March 6th, right?
But, oh, okay.
Like
so you know
happy.
How you always hear, like, oh, those damn millennials, they're so lazy and entitled, right?
It's true.
You hear that.
Well, right.
It's
so
not true, though.
Right. So it says they're lazy, entitled, and selfish, right, and that we're shallow, right? But IBM
right.
did a global study of a multi-generational study of millennials and everybody in the workplace. And first of all, let me just state that by 2020, millennials will be approximately 50% of the U.S. workforce. Okay?
That sounds about right. Yep.
In 5 years. So first, one of the myths, and I'll just say the myth, and then we'll all describe how they, but they said like, well, this one doesn't really matter, but they said that, you know, how we want to be like first, right? No, what we really just want is transparency.
Yep.
And so they were talking about you know, and so it's like, dude, and one of the other things is like, oh, these damn millennials, because they're online, they mix their personal with business because no one cares about anything. But really, we don't mix business and pleasure because they are separate. They've always been separate. We were born in the digital age. And it was saying that 27% of millennials never have like done a thing where they've used a personal email for a business purpose, compared to only 7% of quote baby boomers currently.
You know, that makes sense.
Right, it does make a lot of sense. You always get like the older guys who are like, here's my Hotmail, or here's my
Yeah, exactly. While in the meantime, I understand the purpose of having multiple ones, and I think that's it comes down to not necessarily that
I've probably had like 15 emails
in the digital
accounts.
Age.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's being more familiar, just more.
Well, until I got to the one that I'm at now,
landscape.
Right? Until I am now. I got to Gmail and I was like, all right, I'm done.
Yeah, Gmail lasts a while, but I think that makes sense. You know, everyone likes to bash on the newer generations, of course, and say they have this different principles that are not as good as the previous generation, of course, and all that's what they always say. But in reality, it's just different.
And what
you're saying is essentially millennials are more in tune with sort of the digital age. And,
well, and that's what it pretty much said.
Understanding a digital presence.
There wasn't a difference between generations. the only difference was technological understanding. That was the only difference. Like, everything else was the same. Want to increase your job flexibility, want to, you know, move up in the ranks, want to, you know, be productive, want to listen to your boss, want to, you know, act out, want to whatever, right? They were all the same. But the only thing that was different was the fact that millennials understood technology that much differently because they were we were born into it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's obvious. I mean, if you talk to any, most baby boomers are a little bit still, most, not all, but most or many are still kind of scared by technology in a weird way. You know, they're still worried about,
right? like dad.
You know, they're, yeah, exactly. Well, dad or my mom or my Maxine's parents, my wife's parents,
they start to use it a little bit, and then they focus on that, and they're really good at that, and that seems to be like okay, but then they can't take that understanding and like transfer it. Or not everybody, right. But a lot of people can't take that understanding and transfer it to like this other device when it operates the exact same way.
reminds me what it was like teaching my dad how to use his new phone.
Right. Exactly.
You're like, no, it's the same way. There's no difference. This is the button. Just do it.
His credit, it was his first smartphone, so it was a bit different.
But there is a computer.
You can use a phone.
There is something.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Yeah, there's something about growing up with technology, and like I don't have a problem with it because I started with technology pretty early. I mean, I've always been an early adopter of technology, and that when I get in front of a computer or a new device,
you're Generation X, right?
What's that?
You're Generation X.
Yeah, Generation X. Yeah, Generation X.
You're right in between.
Right in between. But the issue is that like when I get on a computer screen. And if it's a program I've not used before or whatever, I have this confidence that I can figure it out. It's going to be logical. There's going to be some logical sort of flow in terms of how I'm going to click on this and click on that. And it's going to work. I'm going to figure it out pretty shortly. You know what I mean?
Hey, Kurt, can
but
I tell you something?
That's not how. Go ahead.
Your guys' entire generation is so boring that they didn't even give you a name. They just gave you a letter.
Was better than Generation Y, which just came out.
We're the millennials.
No. Millennials
generation
is a new
Y,
term.
And then
generation
there's millennials.
Y. Millennials are people born after 2000.
No. They're born like 90s.
Yeah, no, the definition has changed now.
I'm not even a millennial. Yeah.
You know what I think is so interesting about this whole?
I only have a letter 2 then if I'm a Y.
So I think it's so interesting because you say the study is true and that our principles to some degree are still the same as previous generations. The only thing different is us understanding technology.
Right.
It's so fascinating how different it is, how much of a sort of divide that it creates and how much that the previous generations perceive us as having different principles and being different, even though it is just a small change of turns out we only know how to use Facebook.
Yeah, well, what's funny about that is that, like, you'll talk to older people. I talk to older people every day, and one of the things they'll say is, God, I wouldn't want to raise kids in this generation. You know, it's got to live. And it's like, you know, actually, this is one of the best generations to raise kids in. It was a little tougher, actually, raising, like, my generation when the technology was just coming online, because when we were just coming online, it was like there was no parental blocking, you know what I mean? There was nobody really understood that you shouldn't be sending dick pics to one another. You know what I'm saying? Whereas like your generation is like, okay, we figured out no more dick pics. You know what I'm saying? Like you figured
out. We just keep staying ahead of the apps to send dick pics better and better ways.
Right.
Exactly. Right.
What I'm saying is that like the transition is the hard generation, really. Because you know, you're adapting to a new technology, but the generation after us is grown up with it. Like my kids don't even know a world without smartphones. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like they've never had to, you know, deal with less than 780 channels on TV plus YouTube. All that stuff,
what
you
is
know
this?
What I mean?
Is like, this 40 world. Channels, man?
That's right. I mean, when I was a kid, there were 7 channels. That was it. You know.
All right.
I mean?
So take this study at the grain of salt to say that this multi-generational study was 1,800 employees from organizations of many different sizes across 12 countries, and it was conducted through group discussions, tweet chat, and one-on-one interviews.
Interesting.
Huh.
Well, the thing is, but what I'm saying is, like, in a way, it's better time to raise your kids because we have cell phones and things like that. When our parents were kids, they could just run off and do whatever. And from a statistical standpoint, the world was a much more dangerous place. You know, violent crime was much higher than it is now in terms of crime rates.
That's
because
you
like
had
that.
To run uphill in the snow 5 miles.
So, ironically, things are safer than they've ever been. Right. And like my kids are walking around with a tracking device and a cell phone in their pocket. So
right. And what about that new thing that came out? There's like that new ad that came out. It's like $20 a month and you carry it around. You just press a button and like someone talks to you through it and anywhere in the world or anywhere in the U.S.
Right, exactly. Oh, yeah. I mean, these are the things that, in a lot of ways, it's safer than it's ever been, you know, and right. it's easier than it's ever been.
Well, like, here in the U.S., let's say in the U.S.,
true.
Right? I mean,
true.
Like there's that whole thing about India and the rape thing. So, like, there are other places where it is not safe. But in the U.S., it is getting safer gradually every year, yes.
Oh, yeah, of course. And not only that, but, like, I can log on right now and see how many homework assignments my kids have turned in. And what kind of grades they're getting on it. Like, I could tell you right now to the point how many points they have in a class. My parents, I mean, they had no idea what my grades were.
They had
my,
no, yeah.
My, no
they
idea.
Had to wait
you know?
Until you
and my parents even cared. My
forged.
Parents, yeah, my parents cared.
Right, exactly.
And I still, like, you know.
Right, you know, so it's just, yeah. It's just,
I agree.
You know,
I agree.
It's easier in a lot of ways is what I'm getting at. So it's just interesting.
You're such an overbearing father. Gosh.
So, all right. Well, do you guys want to end it there? Call tonight?
I think so, guys. I really enjoyed it tonight. We expanded on a few topics, and I think we explored the well thoroughly.
All right. Well, it's good to talk to you both.
A lot of fun, guys.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll do it again, hopefully, next week.
Sounds good.
I hope so.
All right. Have a good night, guys.
Bye.
You have a great one.
Bye.